You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following is a message from Zingerman's. From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a four-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.
Bring it in live, team. It's 4 o'clock, a little bit past, 4:11. Running a little late today. This is Unfiltered here on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com and your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with...
me, Brian DeMarco. Good to see you again, Aaron.
Good to see you. Keeping cool in the studio on lovely June 28th. A shout out to our videographer's husband's birthday, Richard Webley. Happy birthday.
Okay. Is that Lucy's husband?
Yep.
Okay, nice. Lucy is our, for everyone who has not been in the studio here at Roberta's, she is our stylist and mascot. And she has got the camera on right now. So good for Lucy. Hopefully we don't look too sweaty and crazy today. But it is a very hot and humid day here in Bushwick. And thank God the studio is air conditioned. Thanks, Jack, for keeping it nice and cool for me. I know that our host is our guest today is not here, Aaron. Who was supposed to be here?
And he's still coming.
Okay.
Yeah, he's going to make a nice appearance in the next couple minutes. The Boar's Head provisions truck was probably blocking Morgan Street for a couple minutes, and it was hard for him to get through. But it's Steve Shaw, and he is of Shaw Vineyards in the Finger Lakes in Seneca Lake. Mm-hmm. So he'll be bringing with him as well a dry Riesling and a Pinot Gris. So we will wait for him, and in the meantime, kind of tap into a story from this past Sunday in the San Francisco Chronicle, talking about Greek winemakers and their best chance as of yet to grab and do a big entry into the U.S. market, given the terrible economy in Greece right now. I'm not sure if you saw this article. Did you?
I have not, but I'm sure you'll enlighten me.
Yeah, okay. Well, basically goes on to talk about the wine sales within the country are down more than 40% over the past 12 months.
Greek wines or wines in Greece?
Greek wines in Greece. Wines made from Greece.
In the U.S.?
Nope. Actually, this is talking about 90% of the production in Greece was consumed within Greece. Mm-hmm. Has been. So in the past 12 months, the country has been down 40% in terms of wine sales. So it's a kind of bringing up the question about whether or not this is Greece's chance to potentially tap the international market, the export market, a bit further, just as Italy did after the bad reputation as bulk producers, and educate the world on some of the Greek varieties that haven't been seen. So it goes into discussions with different importers and wholesalers in the U.S. as to whether or not this would fly, essentially.
What do you think? Do you think that people, the Greek population, just stopped drinking their own wines? I mean, or is it really the sign of the economy? They're just not spending the same kind of money and not going out. And
I think it's hard to gauge the effect of this crisis over there from here, but that it's very bad. So that it's not of a lack of interest, but of a lack of funds for the consumption having dropped that much.
Do you think that beyond the obvious Greek segments here in the Northeast, and there's a few pockets all along the shores here. But do you think there's widespread acceptance of Greek wine there, like there has been Spanish wine or Australian wine? Do you think that?
I don't think it's quite at that point. I think there's certainly a level of intrigue about it, curiosity. You know, Greece has a number of different varieties that are planted, and from everything from those crisp piney whites to heartier reds that have a nice I feel like I've had a few interesting selections, but I wouldn't say that people are about to clear out 12 SKUs in their book for Greek wines. Right, but right. I would defer to you as a wholesaler importer to answer that question if you see it.
Well, we're looking for whites from the islands, and we thought that there could be some interest there. And I really was trying to stay away from sort of that resin-based Retsina style wine, because I think that's what a lot of neophytes would attribute to Greek wines, and sort of like the what you'd get at a Greek restaurant or a Greek diner in Queens or something. But I think those wines are interesting, and they're obviously made well. And Greece has long been a producer of very high quality white wines, and some of the reds I think are interesting. I don't think they're necessarily there yet, because it's just not a real demand for red Greek wines. But there was a couple shows in the city that passed, I think in the spring, there was wines from Santorini, and I went and checked that out, and there were some interesting wines there, and they're being, for the most part, anything that's been presented is carried here in the U.S. already. So unless there's going to be some, it's kind of a catch-22, if there's EU funding or there's an idea to push Greek wines into the zeitgeist of buyers and people, because Greece is in trouble and we need to export wines from Greece to make a market, then I just don't know how they're going to have the money or the exposure to really get that out there unless they really make a price to quality fight. So if Greek wines become very inexpensive, there might be an opportunity.
I think your point too, in terms of just a bit of a disorganization or lack of marketing for Greek wines abroad, has it touches upon this in the article, that has been notoriously disorganized. So trade efforts in the U.S. have been small and narrowly focused. Without sort of that leadership, whether that is subsidized by the EU or by the country itself, it could kind of not go anywhere.
Right. So how far are we from our host, our guest? I keep saying our host.
I think that he's actually arriving right now. So why don't we take a short break, and then we'll come back. This is Unfiltered on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Welcome back to Unfiltered on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick.
And Brian DeMarco.
Here we are. And we're joined this afternoon with our guest, Steve Shaw from Shaw Vineyards. Welcome.
How are you guys? Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, you can put on those headphones and we'll get started here. So, I just recently had an introduction to Shaw Vineyard via the portfolio Verity Wines and Bill Bendelow, who we just mentioned. Hey, Bill, hope you're listening.
And out to my shouts out to Steve Duran, friend and colleague, and co-owner of Faraday Wines. So we're tasting your wines here on air, buddy, so you owe me one.
Actually, the story of Shaw Vineyard begins in Brooklyn, actually in Verity, the history of Shaw Vineyard in Verity. I met Steve Duran at a tasting on a rooftop, so it's pretty crazy. So
how long ago was that?
Oh, my God. Like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
Like that.
And then this is the, and then when was the season that you started with them? I know they're relatively new, I'd
May
say.
May 1st.
Oh, really? Okay.
2011. Yeah,
right,
just started.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah,
yeah. And had your wines been in circulation in the New York market prior?
Probably for 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah, right around there. 4 or 5 years have been in the New York market. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the production of the wines?
3,000 cases we do. So very small production.
Very small.
It's a big production for two guys. It's my father and I, but small production in the grand scheme of things. Yeah. Yeah.
So bathtub gin to Shaw Vineyards, huh?
Totally. 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 Basement hooch. Yeah.
What's how many vines do you have under plant?
We have, as far as acres, we have 60 acres, 22 of vinifera. So 22 vinifera and about, 40, 45 Labrusca. Labrusca is like Catawba, Concord, et cetera, all the old school varietals.
So you can do your jelly jam when... You're not doing the...
No, we refuse to do that. No, never. No. No, we will not do it.
Nice. Nice. What do you do with those extra grapes? The other 40
We
acres?
Sell them... We sell them off to Constellation, Royal. So we sell them off to some of the bigger companies, some of the big guys. So, yep.
And then with regards to the history, when your father... How did he come across purchasing a vineyard up in the Finger Lakes?
He was about 24 years old.
Wow.
1979, he bought a vineyard property from a married couple, for the Taylor Wine Company. So it was on the east side of Keuka Lake, overlooking the bluff. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Keuka Lake or Finger
I've only
Lakes
been up
general.
There. I need to do a nice, thorough tour of the region. I've only been up twice.
Unfiltered does the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, we will do that. Yeah.
Lucy, can you arrange that?
With pleasure, she can. There's actually been a lot of farmers that we've been wanting to get up and visit as well, in terms of just sourcing some products that are great from up there. So,
absolutely.
So then your dad had intention to cultivate the land further and be the winemaker, or did he just buy the land?
Well, trying to be 24 years old back in 79, right, get a bank loan is unheard of. Mm-hmm, it just wasn't happening. And talking about vinifera, so he planted Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon in those vineyards on Keuka Lake, and people thought he was crazy, because we're talking, this is late 70s, it was the height of hybrids, so basically he saw what was going on out in Napa on the west coast and wanted to plant some vinifera. And we have a Chardonnay right now in a cab that those vines are, 32 years old
now?
So that's pretty
amazing.
Old. It's pretty old vinifera for New York State. So.
Well, and not necessarily the great varietals that you associate with the Finger Lakes either.
And the Rieslings, when did you plant those?
Probably, they're from our Seneca Lake property. They're probably planted in 01, right around there, probably early 2000s. So.
Do you see that? We always talk about global warming, and I have worked with some producers in the Niagara Peninsula who think that even a few temperature degrees change gives them an extra week or two of hang time. How do you think do you believe in global warming?
No, I don't believe in global warming.
Excellent.
No. Whatsoever.
Are you also going to vote for Sarah Palin?
Who's she?
Excellent.
Two for two.
No, but I guess to my question, though, if you guys see longer summers or some more hang time, you're going to get riper fruit, and there's going to belie the logic that you can't grow proper high, beyond high yielding sort of, low quality fruit up there. Now I think it's possible to do so. Without incredible green harvesting, you might be able to do it now.
We're going to leave the fruit on regardless. We harvest everything probably mid-November. That's about month after everybody else. So we do this anyway. So that's the risk you take being in upstate New York. You might lose your fruit.
Mm-hmm.
We already lost our marbles. So,
Well, what's the closest market that supports you up there in terms of high?
Rochester, New York is probably
Rochester.
Rochester would be the backyard of the Finger Lakes, if you will. So, and I think our best market is New York. I live here. You know, I'm close you're by. New York, I live in Harlem. Boy? Yeah, oh, good. I live in Harlem. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me, in Rochester, what which one of your wines goes with a garbage plate?
Oh God, I think that's.
Why don't you explain what a garbage plate is to our listeners?
Garbage plate is basically like a Rochester classic, Rochester standard. You can get it at Nick Tahoe's or Bill Gray's.
Nick Tahoe's is like, the place.
It's like cheese fries with, we're talking cheese fries with gravy, with chili, potato skins. It's like every which way of pub food
just to get you through those harsh winters.
Totally smashed onto a plate, right, onto a garbage plate.
Onto a garbage plate, and it's ridiculous. And so you're basically, you know, that's what makes Jenny Cream Ale taste the way it tastes. So yeah, I logged some time in Rochester, as you can tell. But so you think which wine goes with the garbage plate?
With the garbage plate? Oh man, I'd have to like pass it off to like a local beer, man. You know?
No. Like, come on, a red. What red do you make that's gonna work with
the garbage plate? Oh man, that's like,
what? It's a culinary stump.
Definitely thrown you.
That's like that question. That's like that question in City Slickers, where he's like, "What ice cream like can go with any meal?" You know what I'm saying? And he's like,
"Vanilla."
Billy Crystal's like sautéed fish, and the dude's like, Ira's like rum raisin. That's like random.
Well, so is that comment. I love it. Yeah. I love it.
But it never happened. So
it's happening right now. Yeah. It's happening.
You got the oh, there it is right there. There's a garbage plate. No, just kidding.
You're at Roberta's. We can conjure that up.
This is my premiere at Roberta's. Yeah, oh. First time. Yeah.
But no, I've you know, having spent one very cold summer in Rochester, I can tell you that reason
summer.
Summer, cold summer in Rochester.
Yeah, yeah.
I can tell you reasoning wouldn't have been the first thing I was thinking about drinking. So tell me why you guys moved to a plan of reasoning in 2001 and how you think that's going to, you know, lend to the future of your estate.
I think Riesling is, there's a great opportunity for Riesling. There's a great opportunity for Bordeaux and Loire varietals as well, and Burgundy varietals. Riesling has kind of been the popular kid, the rock star, whatever you want to call it, for the Finger Lakes specifically. And there's lots of wineries down here that produce Riesling, but they get their Riesling from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows where that is, but I think as a region overall, Molesworth is definitely taking notice. People like yourselves are taking notice. The people at Wine Enthusiast have been very kind to us and many other, you know, great producers. Mm-hmm. But I think overall, yeah, Riesling has definitely been at the forefront as far as what people know the Finger Lakes for.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't want the Finger Lakes to get pigeonholed into that
right.
one varietal, mm-hmm. because where would Napa be if you only thought of them for one varietal? So
you mean Cabernet?
They're growing the wrong varietals out in Napa, if you ask me, to be totally honest. But anyway.
What do you think they should be growing?
You should be growing Sangiovese, Nero d'Avola, Italian varietals, Southern Italian varietals.
But some of them have played with that, and I don't think that they...
Well, Zinfandel is an Italian varietal.
Primitivo, it's his cousin. Yeah, right. But Cab Sauv and Cab Franc are lower cold climate. They're cool climate red mm-hmm. wines. They're cool climate grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally think they're...
Are there
the
any...
alcohol is too high. Mm-hmm. They're just... It's off. It's
so
off.
Syrah, you like Syrah from California?
I don't really drink a lot of wine from California, to be honest with you. I like a lot of wineries from California. Chateau Patel is fantastic. Pride Mountain is fantastic. Copan is fantastic. So a lot of good wineries.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to keep it as local as possible as far as like,
so
when
if you,
I'm drinking
if you're,
something.
So if you're thinking about your winery in terms of Old World, then where do you think that the style of wine that you're making, which I'm drinking right now, tell me about this wine before we go any further.
This is our 2007 Dry Riesling. It's very Alsatian in style. We're very Old World inspired.
As your labels also sort of indicate.
It's inspired by the Celtic Tree of Life, kind of got like a Celtic nod. It's made to look like a grapevine. It's kind of my dad's idea to kind of put it into
I like it.
As far as a grapevine style. Thank you. I've heard mixed reviews about the label, but most of them are good, so it'll take the good with the bad.
Yeah, you can't please everyone, but this is mighty fine.
Mm-hmm. I like
thank
this.
You
mm-hmm.
I think you. This has got some interesting notes to it. I mean, it's not one dimensional at all, and it's got it's a little greasy, which I like, and it's got some real body to it, and there's some herbaceousness to the Riesling that I would not have pigeonholed for upstate. And it's funny that you say Alsace versus Germany. Why
it has a weightiness a little bit to it. But yeah, I'll let you answer that question.
Why Alsace versus Germany?
I don't think our style is as sweet as something like from Moselle or just a German style. The German style to me is very sweet, but it's good. It's a good wine. German wines are fantastic, but this is just a little bit, for me, a little more food friendly. Mm-hmm. It's a little more balanced. You've got acidity.
Having just come back from Germany recently, over 90% of the wines made in Germany are dry style, and almost 99% of the wines drunk in Germany are all dry. So if you talk to a German winemaker, they almost look down their nose at sweet wines as export wines, kind of like we'll sell those because people want them, and that's what keeps the lights on. But I think
that's paying their bills. How can they hate it?
Well, exactly. They don't hate it, but I think that their domestic market and the Austrian market, who is also drinking a lot of German wines, they're really focused on the drier style, which mm-hmm. this is, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any RS on this wine?
0.8, 0.9, right around there.
Because mm-hmm. I can't really taste. It's not detectable, but we are in the wine business, so we mm-hmm. can kind of get what's going on here. And that adds a little bit of viscosity, right?
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. But, as far as the Finger Lakes in general, it is good as far as the lakes themselves. The lakes themselves are carved out by glaciers, et cetera. I mean, you guys probably know the story. But walk through rows of Riesling, rows of, whatever varietal, is going to be shale, bits of shale all over the soil, mm-hmm. all into the soil. So earthiness in the reds, minerality in the whites. So mm-hmm.
to this particular plot where you have planted Riesling is on shale and in a mixture of what other else?
It's topsoil, just your typical northeastern topsoil, that mud, as opposed to, once you get down south, you've got clay, etc. But the typical northeastern topsoil, typically that was used a lot of the farmland in upstate New York. You've got dairy farms, you've got corn,
mm-hmm.
you've got, all types of orchards, etc. So
are these vineyard plantings, are they sloped in, or a little bit steep, or are they more flat?
Slightly sloped, yes. Okay. Nothing like Northern Italy.
Going to
like
the Mosel and walking up those steep
like
hills.
No,
okay.
Nothing like Europe, no. But gentle decline.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so.
Great. Well, we have another wine, too. I want to take a short break, and we're going to return to taste that wine and continue onwards. This is Steve Shaw from Shaw Vineyard in Finger Lakes. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Unfiltered. Welcome back to the studio. This is a live recording, 4 p.m. Tuesdays, every Tuesday here for about half an hour, 40 minutes. and a little sampling from Fits in the Tantrums, which is making Brian giddy up in his seat a bit. So I know they're playing right now in New York in various locales. We'll try to check them out on stage. Pretty good jam.
Yeah. So like a little Sly and the Family Stone meets something else I can't think of. But yeah, we've got our guy here from Shaw Vineyards, and he's tasting us through some of these delicious wines from the Finger Lakes. And it's interesting because you told me that your label has mixed reviews, and I'm looking at it, and it's kind of old school and kind of simple and really classic, and I don't understand why anyone would think it's... I mean, there are a lot of douchey people out there that don't know what they're talking about.
Good question. Yeah. Well, that's as far as like mixed reviews, that's one. So it's like, you know, if you're on Yelp, you've got, you know, 25 good reviews and one bad review. There's always that one, you know, jerk. You know what I mean? So,
well, a lot of jealous people out there.
But that person actually carries our wine, so.
There you go.
It's all good.
So.
It's all good. Like, I'm laughing, you know, so.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, we just finished up the previous segment tasting the 2007 Riesling, and Steve's brought a 09 Pinot Grigio as well. And during the break, we were just talking about how your winery is actually known for its reds, and we talk about those after we taste this white as well. But again, you mentioned not pigeonholing the Finger Lakes region for being known for their Rieslings only or their whites, which I think certainly there is that identity, but that there's a lot more going on there as well. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And also just to give our listeners a little bit of a scope of, you know, the region as a whole, and like there's all these lakes and how one particular area might differ from another, you know, within the greater region. So you want to bring us into this next wine?
The next is our Libella Pinot Gris. It's our second label. This is my little project. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. The label itself is a little more... A little more fun.
Playful.
It's a little less serious, but the wine quality is the same. It's the same methods, same standards that we use.
What's going on with the blue bottle?
First vintage, I did half in blue glass, half in green glass. Did an experiment. People went crazy for the blue, so you can't argue.
I was wondering maybe if Saratoga Water Company had a sale on their bottles or something. And you just picked them up.
No, I took them all from the Blue Nun.
Yeah, right.
I'm going straight to hell. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
But people love blue. They love it. I don't know why, but they love it.
Right.
But it's it makes for an interesting, you know, makes for an interesting package. So the design of this particular wine has been kind of different. We had a blue bottle, always blue, but then like a gold
silver
capsule
foil.
Like a gold capsule at first. I like the silver bottle better.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And that's a dragonfly, or is that
that's a dragonfly? Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. So
it's kind of fun. It's kind of.
And when was the first vintage that you did of this?
2006.
Okay. So.
And it was sold in 2007. So yeah, this will be what, 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right on. Well, immediately when I gave it a first smell, it was definitely had a little bit more of like a funkiness to it, you know, not that sort of herbaceous quality that you might get from some of the Pinots or the high-tone watery
quality.
Well, let's give it a little bit of credit.
Pinot Grigio has been totally destroyed by the big companies. Yeah. So totally, totally destroyed.
Well, but this has more of a Friulian sort of quality to me.
Alto Adige, mm-hmm. a little bit.
My favorite winery in Friuli is Furlan.
I know that one.
Furlan,
yeah.
They Parker said they had the best Pinot Grigio in the world in 82, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they're still using that today, to this day.
I'm sure.
I would.
Yeah.
But anyway, but the,
no
the dog barking yeah. when Parker, when you mentioned yeah. Parker.
That's the alarm. You said Parker. The
Hang
dog
on. Wait,
barks.
Wait. Parker.
Woof.
Molesworth.
We like James. James.
Draley.
We like Kevin.
Vaynerchuk.
There's some high tones of douchiness involved there as well.
Okay. All right, let's bring it back. Let's bring it back.
He's like the godfather, Hugh Johnson. You know what I mean?
Hugh Johnson's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
Clive Coates is actually one of my faves. And Aaron, you've been to a couple Clive Coates events with me.
I have, yeah.
When he gets in his...
He's a legend.
He gets into his ramble and his like mumbling, it's just, you're just like... I love it. Whatever you're saying is great.
But don't send him an email because he sure as hell won't open it.
He always does the Wall Street wine competition. The Finger Lakes Winery won that, actually. It was part of the Wall Street Dozen. So,
cool.
Shout out to White Springs Winery on Seneca Lake. So
nice.
Hey, everybody
nice.
Gets a plug, man. You know.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
But they got one of the Wall Street Dozen for their corporate case, whatever you want to call it. So
I'm thinking now, this is not card catalog Rolodex versus digital. I was somewhere in the 90s. I was at some resort on Seneca Lake, and there was some corporate outing that we did, and there's a steakhouse or something on Seneca Lake that should be serving this wine. Do you remember the steakhouse? What is the prime restaurant up there? It's like one, like, right on the lake.
Suzanne Fine Regional Cuisine is probably the best.
That's the place.
It's probably the best restaurant in the Finger Lakes, if you ask me. The food is phenomenal. There's a lot of great places, but they're insane. They're really, really good. They're in Kaywood or Lodi, New York. It's right on the border, nice. In between Kaywood. And yes, there is a Lodi, New York as well.
And how have you seen just, you know, your involvement with the winery in the past couple of years, the push, the response from the New York market with people supporting it more and more?
It's gotten a lot better. I've lived in New York since 2003 and have worked at some liquor distributors, mm-hmm. Eber Brothers Wine and Liquor, back in 2003, and Peerless as well. And when we first started out, so my father and I've been in the business for 30 years. I've been working in vineyards since I was a kid. So old enough to walk, old enough to pick grapes. So basically, but after I was working in the industry for a couple years in sales. I don't know, 06, late 06, early 07, something like that. The local movement, whatever you want to call it, was kind of starting. Yeah. A lot of people in the city have been way ahead of the curve, but mm-hmm. started getting press. It was hip to be local, you know. Yeah. But a lot of stores, when I first went in and started showing the wines, I said, "Steve, I love you, babe, but you know, this is doesn't sell. New York wine does not sell." Mm-hmm. It's just mm-hmm. that.
So, how have you overcome that? Because I mean, I know the same argument, and I
went back in.
I tried
and again and again
as an importer wholesaler of you know nice wines. I tried to support local New York, and we've even tried to take on some Long Island wines, but they're just, the market isn't there to, unless you're going to do crazy numbers or there's a specific item like Blue Bottle Pinot Grigio where you can sell 10 pallets of it, then maybe, you know, maybe there's an opportunity there. But my idea is that no one in New York, it seems to be, since we're so cosmopolitan, or even there's so many choices here, no one's that loyal to New York specific things.
There's never been a marketing budget by the state of New York. Europe provides government stipends, government support to wineries, to the wine industry specifically. New York State spends nothing. Mm-hmm. They spend $2 million. That's it.
Right.
So
right.
Cuomo, start spending some money on New York wine. It's bringing you revenue. So
that's there is a, fair, a political
it's a fair
shout
argument.
Out.
Yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, it's the New York State wine industry. New York State is roughly, it's always in the top five as far as gallons produced in the country.
Yeah,
New York State used to be the number one dairy state, too. Anyway, but well, used to be a great manufacturing state.
I hope that
state,
trend comes back
above.
As well.
Yeah. Long Island used to be the Peking duck capital of the world.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. For or sure. Just Long Island ducks.
The Harbs family, they're out on Long Island. They used to have corn fields, and now they're growers now, the Harbs family. Mm-hmm. I've been to, like, who's the Len Thompson. He's known out there. He's a good guy. Yep.
Cork Report?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
exactly.
Len's a good guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then to talk about your reds, because I don't want to leave the program without mentioning, you know, what you grow there and how they become kind of synonymous with your vineyard.
We definitely have a cult following for our reds. Nobody's really doing what we're doing. We're 100% wind powered. I mean, there's a lot of wineries out there across the country that are wind powered, but I don't know, you know, too many in our area that are doing 100% wind power from NYSEG. NYSEG is a power supplier up in upstate New York. And but as far as what we do, we're cropping 2 to 3 tons an acre. Everything is gravity fed. No must pump. As far as no crusher, we only have a destemmer. But we use whole berry fermentation for our reds. All our reds are in oak for about 36 months. Yes, 36 months. Yes, Heights has got us beat out in Napa. They make a good bottle of wine too. But they've got us beat. But it's very old world inspired. My dad did not create this, you know, as far as cold soaks as well. He did not create this, but I think he's one of the first people on the East Coast to really actually do it. It's very labor intensive. I mean, wine is an insanely labor intensive liquid.
Sure. It's also an investment
fine
to have
wine.
Something in barrel for 3 years. You know, you're looking at your return.
That's
on investment.
A real risky stock.
Well, let me ask you, there obviously is enough fruit then for there to be wood for 3 years. So tell me, you do have a red for me to taste today, or do
I don't? I just it's hot. It's like 85 degrees.
I'm aware of that. Yeah, it's that's why the air conditioning is cranking in here.
Yeah, he's gonna come back.
Hell yeah,
we'll come back in the fall. We'll do a whole red segment.
Thank you for the invite. Sweet. If I had like a bell, I'd ring it for you guys. Props. I got gold stars in my back pocket.
Excellent.
So
ding ding.
Yeah.
So, Aaron, what's your favorite wine here? This Pinot Grigio or that Riesling?
I actually prefer the Riesling. The first one we tasted. I think both of them have a nice acidity, but I do sort of like the finish, the length of the Riesling a bit more, and the Pinot Grigio finishes a bit sweeter for me, actually.
Well, let me, I hate to do Steve's job for him, but, you know, where can we find these wines in New York City, and how much is the Riesling on the shelf, my friend?
Riesling is about $16, $17. The Pinot Gris runs from 12 to 14. You're going to find insane, insane value in the Finger Lakes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're not, a lot of wines, the retail price on the shelf really goes back to the real estate. So, Burgundy, an acre of land is at least $1 million, $1.5 million, maybe two, depending on, mm-hmm. you know, Johnny Depp has what, like 20 acres in Burgundy? That's mm-hmm. pretty amazing. Napa, prime Napa is what, $250,000 to $400,000? I mean, it's very...
Depending on where you are, yeah.
Yeah, it's if it's Stag's Leap, you know, something like that.
And
it's
then very upstate? Expensive. And upstate?
Upstate is a fraction of that. I mean, I don't want to... I'm not going to...
Give away
I'm not
going to
give away what the price is, but I don't want anybody coming up and... You know, going
well, gas
crazy.
Prices are up, so it's a lot. It's a lot of miles between upstate and here. So
that's
we're trucking that wine down here.
That's but, true.
So any key retailers you want to shout out that can get the wines?
The best thing for people to do is go onto ShawVineyard.com, and you can take a look at all of our retailers. Everybody deserves their due and proper for carrying something local. Shaw Vineyard also supports Last Store on Main Street. Last Store on Main Street is an organization. I grew up in a wine shop, so my mother's side of the family owns a wine shop. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, we support Last Store on Main Street, and that's something that it's a coalition, if you will, of New York State retailers, New York State wine shop owners that are were for the indie stores. So
excellent.
Well, thanks so much for joining today, and I look forward to our field trip up there. And
thanks, guys.
Seeing
appreciate
the vineyard
it. Thank you very much
for coming by.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, all over the internet and also in all of the meat trade papers, as well as in this particular article on digital trends, a story has been running about the poop burger. Japanese scientists have found a way to create artificial meat from sewage containing human waste. Mitsuyuku Ikeda, a researcher from the Okayama Laboratory, has developed steaks based on proteins from human excrement. Tokyo Sewage approached the scientists because of an overabundance of sewage mud. They asked him to explore the possible uses of the sewage, and Ikeda found that the mud contained a great deal of protein because of all the bacteria. The researchers then extracted those proteins, combined them with a reaction enhancer, and put it in an exploder, which created the artificial steak. The meat is 63% proteins, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals. The researchers color the quote-unquote meat red with food coloring and enhance the flavor with soy proteins. Initial tests have suggested people say that it even tastes like beef. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Kate Kiefer.
There's no problem that Dave Arnold can't solve on his show, Cooking Issues. Take a little listen.
So Naveen writes in and says, "Hi, Dave. I'm fascinated by chocolate, especially the transformation from the bitter seeds of the cacao tree to a tasty chocolate bar. That is a very interesting transformation. Are there any other foods that undergo a similar set of steps, fermentation, roasting, grinding? Also, do you know of any other tropical fruit seeds that could become delicious through such a process? Thanks, Naveen." That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously coffee, right? Coffee goes through a similar set of procedures, quite literally, fermentation, drying, roasting, grinding, brewing. And vanilla goes through picking, fermentation, right? It's dipped in, usually in boiling water, and then wilted, and then fermented. So it's similar, and then I guess it can be ground to form a paste. But vanilla doesn't taste like vanilla until it goes through its paces to be fermented. In fact, the vanilla that's uncured is called red vanilla. You can get it. It's interesting.
If you like what you hear, you can hear a new show every Tuesday noon on the Heritage Radio Network, or subscribe to the podcast, or check out the archives on our website.